Welcome to The Lob, your home of in-depth coverage and analysis by These Football Times, a movement of journalism you can trust. Each week, we endeavour to bring you the very best coverage of the game, exploring stories from the past and present with analysis by expert guests from around the world. Find more of our award-winning content online and in print. In the meantime, enjoy the podcast.
Hello and welcome to another edition of the Lob podcast with These Football Times. My name is Stuart Horsfield and I'm delighted to say that this edition is once again celebrating another of the wonderful These Football Times magazines. And this time we've gone back to Holland for PSV Eindhoven.
Carlos Moza made it look easy and every single spot kick of the 10 has been scored. So Janssen in sudden death. PSV substitute makes it 6-5. Veloso now. Benfica haven't won the European Cup since 1962. Veloso with a kick. Van Breukelen saves. And the wait goes on for Benfica. PSV Eindhoven are European champions for the first time. They are the third Dutch side to win this trophy. What an achievement for PSV and the city of Eindhoven.
We have another outstanding cover from the incredibly talented Javier Arez, and then we have articles from all the usual suspects. We have articles about Willy van der Kuylen, the rise of the new PSV, the van der Kerkhoff twins, Gus Hiddink, Bobby Robson, Romario, Ronaldo, Nils van Nistelrooy and Kesman. We have Philip Cocu as player and manager, the Philip Stadion, and then developing players, the PSV way, and the relationship between Philips as a company and PSV the club. So plenty to get through. Obviously plenty to read once the magazine drops, and we'll be doing our best for the next hour and a half to convince you to make the purchase. But I'm pretty sure that once you see the cover, that'll all be taken care of. And I'm delighted that to get us through the next sort of hour and a half are the three usual suspects on such an occasion. So first of all, we'll start with Mr. Gary Thacker. Gary, welcome.
Thanks, buddy. Another magazine about Dutch football, so this is right at the centre of the fairway for me. So looking forward to chatting about it. There's some great articles coming up in there, so in the magazine when it's released. So get your orders in quick, guys, because a bit like the Ajax one, this is going to fly off the shelves.
Were you spoiled for choice on this one, Gary? When the club was decided, it took you a while to decide what you were going to do.
No. there's been one outstanding player. That's a ridiculous thing to say, Gary. There's been several outstanding players, but one world star, one phenomenon, shall we say, at PSV. So I went by for him like a laser beam straight away.
Excellent. And obviously, like you say, there is absolutely no doubt that we will be touching on your article and certainly that player as well during this discussion. Next up, Mr. Aidan Williams. Aidan, welcome.
Hello there.
Looking forward to a discussion on PSV Eindhoven?
Absolutely, yes. I mean, it's another intriguing club, isn't it? That until you delve into these depths that we've gone into and all the guys have gone into for these articles, there's so much more to uncover than you might initially think. Even though, you know, off the top of your head, you can think of some of the great players. Gary is suggesting a phenomenon, which is a certain clue, of course. But there's plenty of other great players over the eras at all. So it's it's a really, really interesting club to get into.
It is. And obviously the final sort of co-host, co-commentator, if you like, Mr. Stephen Scragg. Stephen, welcome.
How are you doing, Stuart?
You okay?
Yeah, not so bad. Yeah, looking forward to this.
Sound very chipper for this one.
Well, I think it's one of these, just an eminently likeable football club, whereas, you know, some are quite polarising, others are just, you know, inherently, you know, they're not quite an Ajax, as in that all-encompassing, everyone respects them, maybe apart from Feyenoord supporters. But, you know, PSV, as a football club, I think they're so storied. They've had so many great players and coaches and, you know, eras. But I think the great thing about this magazine is that it kind of touches on all of them. You know, the vast majority of them, at least. Whereas with some clubs, we can touch on them, and there's so much that doesn't make it because there's just, you know, not enough room as such. And that's not saying that PSV haven't done enough, but what it tends to be is that there's almost like a degree of overlap. So for me, I mean, I think this is one of the best magazines we've made.
That was a big statement. That's a little bit.
And I stand by it.
That's a bit of pressure we're under now.
I'm not saying I mean, you always say best one ever, but you know.
But this one really is.
But this one, you know, nothing's going to top Liverpool, obviously. Obviously.
Until the whole city / Newcastle. Well, the whole city. Find one comes out.
Oh, well, yes. The East Coast special will be.
That's it. Yeah.
A completely different kettle of fish, and I'm definitely taking Hartlepool United in that one. I think this is going to be, you know, it is a fantastic magazine, and as a club goes, they're massively likable.
I think you're right. I think this is probably going to be the most inoffensive magazine that we've probably done. I think.
Yeah, without doubt. You know, just so much to like about them. You know, the players and you know, the coaches, the success they've had, the fact that they challenge a traditional megalith as well in Ajax, and not just Ajax, but Feyenoord. You know, you never undersell the significance of Feyenoord, both domestically and in Europe. So for PSV to, you know, emerge from the shadows periodically from these two massive clubs is a huge testament to them, and I'm pretty made up that we've got to do the magazine.
Excellent. And I think I'm right in thinking 9th of November I think this goes online for to be able to purchase, should I say.
And that's right, Matt. Yeah.
So obviously, you know, hope, you know, this will be out before the 9th of November, so if people are listening to this before the 9th, be ready. If it's after the 9th, I don't make any promises. Unlike Stephen, who promises the best magazine ever, I aren't making any promises. You'll still be available if you're listening post 9th of November. So guys, as always, you know, you've all got articles in there, which we'll be chatting about in a bit more detail. But I suppose before then, I guess carrying on from what Stephen's been saying, Aidan, for you, you know, PSV as a club, your sort of overall impression of them as a club?
To me, given the era I grew up in and was first aware of, say, wider European competition, PSV were always one of the top clubs and one of the foremost Dutch clubs, coming through, obviously, their 1988 success in the European Cup, put them on something of a pedestal, and the way that the Dutch national team followed that up in that same summer kind of made Dutch football seem possibly the most relevant it had been since a decade earlier, which I hadn't been aware of at the time, of course. So to me, Dutch football and PSV being prominent went hand in hand. Many of the same players, of course, crossed over both of those. And it followed on from there with Bobby Robson going to PSV after the 1990 World Cup. You know, that caused a bit of a stir amongst the English press. But, you know, his job was disappearing with England, so he had to go somewhere. And then, of course, you hear about the great players who joined in that era. You had Romario, Ronaldo was there, and then moving forwards, They didn't quite reach the same peaks again, of course, but more recently, well, in this century anyway, I recall them reaching a Champions League semi-final earlier this century, and Park Ji-sung was all over the place, running here, there and everywhere, getting himself involved. And moments like that, I think they took on, did they knock out AC Milan or took on AC Milan in a period of their dominance? And they seem to be potentially on the rise again, but they've never been quite of the same stature to actually reach the heights that they did in the 80s and indeed in the 70s too. But they always seem to be one of the foremost Dutch clubs. There's been spells where Ajax have come and gone as well, of course, but PSV seem to be fairly ever-present. Feyenoord, I think, have drifted away far more than PSV have, certainly in an international consciousness, I think. And seeing the way they progressed through, they always seem to be up against Newcastle in our infrequent Champions League campaigns around that time. We played PSV several times, so I guess that kept them fairly prominent in my mind. So, you know, when we get to that East Coast magazine, we'll have a few articles on that.
Neither won't be, but yeah, I get that from your point of view. Gary, I mean, obviously, you mentioned at the beginning, this is sort of right down the fairway for you. You know, this is the absolute sweet spot. And obviously, picking up from what Aidan said there, and obviously, we all know your love of Ajax, so the Ajax side in the early 70s, the Dutch national side of the 70s. And Aidan makes a really good point there with regards to sort of the almost the peaks and troughs of Ajax, sort of post-70s perhaps, you know, the Feyenoord, maybe not quite, you know, obviously the heights of winning the European Cup, but then never sort of replicating that. In terms of PSV, then, in the last, you know, sort of 30, 40 years, where would you put them within the realms of domestic Dutch football?
That's a good question, Stu.
I can't believe it's yours again. I need to change the order. I'm really sorry.
I don't know. I guess it's difficult to say because over time things change so much in Dutch football. I mean, the PSV dominance of Dutch football and their success at the European Cup in 88. I think it was almost like a second wave of Dutch football coming through to sort of, you know, prominence in Europe. I mean, you had the Feyenoord and Ajax of the sort of early 70s. And the great players that fed into the Dutch national team. But yeah, I say it's almost like a second wave. But I'm not sure, although they sort of won the European Cup, I'm not sure, and they won a lot of the Eredivisie, the Dutch league titles on a good stretch. But I'm not quite sure they were ever given the same acclaim that Ajax and even Feyenoord were. And even, you know, people say name three or four Dutch clubs. The first two named off the tongue would probably be Ajax and Feyenoord, which is probably a little bit unfair to PSV because their dominance was probably no less, but perhaps their European success didn't last as long as, you know, in the early 70s with Ajax and Feyenoord. So perhaps it's not as well chronicled in the annals of football, European football history.
It's funny. As you were chatting as well there then, Gary, Stephen, a question for you. In terms of, obviously we've been chatting here about how, the magazine should be interesting to everybody, you know, and we've talked about the appeal of Ajax and the Dutch national side. But so I suppose my question is, why do you think Dutch football is not as offensive or not as polarising as sort of the other major European leagues, or the clubs within Dutch football aren't as sort of offend, you know, you have your Real Madrids, you have your PSGs, your Manchester Uniteds, there are just clubs within certain European countries, domestic football, where it grates a little bit, but Dutch football just seems to, everybody seems to love it and get on with it.
I think it's down to the fact that they've had so many great sides and so many great players, you know, they've always played. I mean, much of it is rooted in that total football theme. So when you talk about Ajax and the Netherlands, then you've got Feyenoord, who, you know, had their own success. Like you said earlier on, they were the first Dutch side to win the European Cup in 1970. So I think they've taken on this almost mythical stature in the game. You know, I don't think there's a particular interest in the Eredivisie as such, but it's there's just something quite hypnotic about football that emanates from the Netherlands. You know, there's a kind of style, but there's a style, but then there's a kind of, not a fragility, but that sense of how they can hit the self-destruct button so effectively from time to time. So it's a precarious sense of genius almost. So for PSV to slot alongside that, they've almost been not predictable, but efficient in everything that they've done in their success. You don't tend to hear the fallouts, and they'll happen, but you don't tend to associate PSV with being that precarious kind of environment where things might just start to fall through because of, you know, clashes of personality or whatever it is. But yeah, in the broader spectrum of it, you know, it's the evocative colour as well. It's orange. It's vivid. You know, the style of football take the 2010 World Cup final out of the equation, it tends to be Europe's version of Brazilian football. So, you know, the football's beautiful, the kits are iconic, you know, the names of the players just trip off the tongue, and, you know, put Johnny Rep or, you know, Rob Rensenbrink, you know, Johan Cruyff, I write about them, the Van der Kerkhoff twins. But then a generation later, you're talking about the Hullets and the Van Bastens and the Rijkaards. And they're the type of players and the types of teams that as soon as you say it, and, you know, Hullet, Van Basten, Rijkaard automatically see red and black stripes. It's not the Netherlands, but they were a Netherlands-powered, you know, superpower of the time. And again, it comes down to that impressionable era that we all grew up in, that, you know, they made an impression. You know, myself, Eustu, and Aidan, too young to remember 74 and 78, effectively enough. But, you know, we have 88 and just how beautiful they were in winning the 1988 European Championships. You know, Van Gaal's Ajax that played a speedball version of total football. So, you know, there's just so much to love about them, so much to respect. But the entertainment levels are always massive, whether it's for positive reasons or negative reasons.
It's a great answer, and one that I can fully subscribe to and buy into. With regards to sort of the age, then we'll look at sort of your guys' articles in a bit more detail. I'm going to start with you, Aidan, and based on what Stephen's just said there about our sort of our generation, if you like, and where our sort of football conscious starts. You decided to go a little bit further back and looked at the rise of, you know, as we've all mentioned there, almost the modern or the new PSV in the 1970s.
Yeah, this is an intriguing era because, I mean, the guys have all mentioned there about the 70s and the iconic images and the successful teams and so on. And it's a very evocative era for Dutch football, as everyone said. This is an era where PSV began the decade, not really one of the Netherlands' biggest clubs, you know, well, in terms of success. It was Feyenoord and Ajax. It was the two. You know, Feyenoord had won the European Cup at the beginning of the decade. Ajax had then won it three times. PSV were just one of the crowd behind that. They weren't the stature that they became. But through the 70s, they actually built themselves up to become part of the three big teams of Holland, if you like, rather than just one of the others. So it's quite an interesting period. I mean, there's some great characters and intriguing players, but it's an era where they came so close to matching what Feyenoord and Ajax had achieved. And had they done so then rather than in 1988 or as well as in 1988, perhaps our impression of them would have been slightly different. And there's just a few key points where they didn't quite get the luck or the benefit of the doubt or so on in certain games that could have gone different ways and history could have been slightly different. But I mean, prior to this era, they'd had success, but it was fairly sporadic. Domestically and in Europe, they'd had occasional European campaigns. They'd reached European Cup quarterfinal in 1964 and a Cup Winners' Cup semi-final at the start of the 70s. This was under a coach called Kurt Linder, who was a little bit strict, shall we say. He was fairly hardline and tough and quite rigid and structured in his approach. And that didn't quite suit what was the burgeoning style in Holland at the time. And that's where it kind of jars. So it's quite interesting to look at in terms of the progression of Dutch football. Obviously, freedom of expression and freedom of thought and space and creativity was behind the rise of Ajax and the Dutch national team. And he didn't quite fit that narrative at this time. And crucially, too, he didn't bring the best out of who PSV's best player at the time was, which is Willy van der Kuylen, who is a very highly skilled attacking midfielder or forward who'd been at PSV for quite some time, but the best just wasn't coming from him because of the slightly more rigid structures he was having to play in. And things changed for both him and PSV hand in hand with the arrival of Kees Rivers in 1972. And this is where the story of PSV as a significant power in the Dutch game begins, really. There was some other key arrivals to join Van der Kuylen, and there was also the excellent goalkeeper Jan van Beveren was at the club as well. Now, he missed out on international selection in the same way Van der Kuylen did a little bit as well, through clashes with Johan Cruyff primarily. So potentially this is why, another reason why, along with the club, they're not as well revered, or history hasn't remembered them quite as well as it might have done, based on their talents, because they didn't make it into the World Cup, or at least not in quite the same way. Some of the other key characters of the era did, but not, they were never the primary ones. It was the Ajax and Feyenoord gang who were the key players in the World Cup teams, whereas PSV, it was certainly in the 1974 standings, they weren't excluded. I don't want to say that, but some of these players clashed a little bit, and they didn't quite get the same recognition. But when it came to the club game, they thrived under Kees Rivers. He allowed Van der Kuylen to have a free role. He built the team around him, and his creativity and attacking prowess pushed PSV onto the achievements they then got. The big breakthrough came in 74 when they won the cup, having knocked out Feyenoord and Ajax in succession in the quarters and semi-final, before a big thrashing of NEC Breda in the final. Now, this was their key breakthrough. They'd won occasional trophies before, but even their previous Cup Winners' Cup success, or semi-success, reaching the last four, that came having only been runners-up in the cup, but to a team winning the double. So this was quite a step up. And the fact that they knocked out Feyenoord and Ajax in succession, I think, was the key to it, because that must have given them the belief. That gave them the step up to that next level, if you like. And now, coinciding, I guess, with a marginal, and I only say marginal, decline for those two, PSV were in position to take full advantage. And they then followed this up by winning the Eredivisie in 75, and they made it to the European Cup semi-final the following year. Unfortunately, then they ran into a fine Saint-Étienne team. Now, Saint-Étienne would prove to be a consistent thorn in the side of this PSV team, coming up against them repeatedly. Now, Saint-Étienne, they beat them 1-0 on aggregate, so it was obviously extremely close. The Saint-Étienne team of this era, if you think of those and you picture them, they're one of the hipster teams of the age, aren't they? They're one that people think very fondly of. It's the fine margins that what they achieved in reaching a final, and the way they were thought of, was very nearly what PSV could have done. You know, it's not a huge stretch of the imagination to swap them around and say, well, it could have been PSV who'd reached the final that year. Would Saint-Étienne have been as well recalled, as well remembered, if it had been that way around? Possibly not so much, and possibly PSV would have been more. They still achieved great success that season as well. They did the domestic double as well as that European semi-final. So it isn't just that they were unlucky in Europe on that occasion in the biggest competition. It nearly was the full set, which would have been astonishingly remarkable. And obviously in 1988, they went that step further. And that's why that team will forever remain their greatest. But this one in the 70s came oh so close to doing likewise. They narrowly missed out on the league the following year, so they went into the UEFA Cup. And now this set up a rather glorious 78 season. Now this is, as much as 76 was so nearly the best of peaks, 78 proved to be their actual peak, because they did win a treble that year, League Cup and UEFA Cup. Significantly in the UEFA Cup, they came up against Barcelona in the semi-finals. Now this is the Barcelona of Rinus Michels, Johan Cruyff and Neeskens. So it was a little bit like the Ajax-PSV rivalry transposed into European competition. They beat them 3-0 at home, which, you know, you might think that would have put them home and dry, but no, 2-0 down in the return leg after only 20-odd minutes left it rather in the balance. They clung on to half-time, which effectively was a major milestone they had to reach. The tide was very much against them for some time in there. renewed energy at half-time, and then up steps the most unlikely of heroes with a Welshman called Nick Deasy, who joined PSV from Hereford United, of all places. There's a good book that one of us has written that covers UEFA Cup that might touch on this as well. So that's a good place to look for more information about that. Stephen's book gives a little bit of extra depth into this era. But PSV, having got over that one and scraped their way through, got to a final against Bastia, where there's another Dutch connection with the enigmatic Johnny Rep. And it was a 0-0 in Corsica in the first leg in what was a very muddy, soggy quagmire of a pitch, which was good for PSV, really, because Bastia in that time were one of the stronger teams, certainly in France and across Europe. So that leveller of a pitch certainly helped PSV at the time. In the return leg, they simply overwhelmed them 3-0. Back in Eindhoven and claim their trophy. Now, I guess in terms of legacy, the fact that this was a UEFA Cup rather than a European Cup diminishes it slightly and certainly reduces the overall impact that this team had. But if you consider those two peaks of 76 and 78, they could so nearly have been really, really glorious and triumphant. And it was still quite astonishing what they did achieve anyway. But imagine if they'd managed to win the 76 one as well. It would have been quite incredible. But this was really taking their place at the top table of Dutch football. And this is an era, as we said, where Dutch football was hugely dominant internationally and in the club game. And PSV had risen through, breaking through that sort of duopoly of Ajax and Feyenoord to take over the top table domestically during that particular spell and to push on to European success. So they really had set their stall out as one of the top teams and made them most definitely part of a top three in the Netherlands that they certainly hadn't been part of up until this era. Now, the decline did set in soon after. Unfortunately, they successive third place finishes in the league and then a hugely disastrous UEFA Cup loss in 79-80 season again to Saint-Étienne. They drew at home before being humbled 6-0 in France. Now, as painful as the European Cup semi-final loss in 76 will have been, this one was so definitive as to be terminal to the team, really. Rivers was sacked soon after, and many of the squad, which had been by far PSV's finest up to that point in their history, soon fell apart. There was key departures and the replacements just weren't quite at the same level. So there was a dip following this period. And obviously this then heralded the next rise, which came in the 80s, which we'll get into shortly, I'm sure. But this particular spell from 74 to 78 in particular, Rivers PSV had been astonishingly good. It had been a rise that had been achieved through quite an impressive mix of skill and strength, but it had gained the best out of the excellent players who were there, particularly Van der Kuyl and his skills. PSV, to kind of signal the end of that era, they produced six players for the 1978 Dutch national squad, which was more than Ajax and Feyenoord combined, which gave a bit of a clear indication of their status domestically, though obviously several of the key players had moved abroad to other countries by that stage. But domestically, they were very much the preeminent team. Even those who didn't make that squad, the likes of Van Beveren and Van der Kuylen, were such world-class players in their own right that they drove the club into uncharted heights that, again, as I say, would only be surpassed by the rise of their next great side in the 80s. So it was a key era that took them from just being an also-ran, one of the crowd in Dutch football, to being one of the big three. And that's a status that they probably never fully have relinquished at any stage since.
It's a fantastic overview of an entire decade of a club's trials and tribulations of a club, which throws up, as we know, is dangerous when I have thinking time, which has thrown up a whole host of questions, Gary. No, it's fine. It's fine. Obviously, okay. As Aidan's alluded to, and as we know, your love of Dutch football, certainly international football, and just picking up from what Aidan was saying there, I'm as a personal interest in terms of sort of PSV's contribution. You know, Aidan mentioned it towards the end with regards to the number of players in the 78 squad, but you know, with regards to the book that you're writing, you know, what was PSV's contribution to that? I suppose it was a 4-year cycle between 74 and 78, but in terms of PSV's influence over that, did it get bigger? Did it increase? Was it always there, but you were dominated by the Ajax players? You know, I'm interested in what PSV's sort of contribution to those two World Cup sides were like.
I think the short answer is what their contribution was less than it should have been, and not that with any criticism of the PSV players, quite reversed. And I had mentioned there Van Coylen and also Jan van Beveren. Now, we've had these sort of discussions when we were talking about the Dutch World Cups in the past and various magazines, that in 74 and 78 and 76 European Championships as well, the Dutch goalkeepers were not the best goalkeepers that should have been playing. And Jan van Beveren was the best goalkeeper. 74, he was with PSV, and this was Mikkels took over the Dutch squad, and there'd always been a bit of friction between Mikkels and PSV, and Van Beveren had been injured and came back into the squad, and Mikkels had arranged a friendly ahead of the tournament against a German club, and I want to say Hamburg, and I might be wrong, but it was just a friendly game, and said to Van Beveren should play to prove his fitness. And Van Beveren, this time, was a well-established goalkeeper, and said, look, you know, I don't want to risk my being injured, and so I think I'll play 45 minutes if you really want me to, but I don't really want to. And they fell out, and Van Beveren got chucked out of the squad. He should have been the goalkeeper. In 76, they were managed by a guy called George Schnobel, who had taken over from Stefan Kovacs at Ajax, when Kovacs left to go to manage France. And it had one season with Ajax. After they'd won 3 European Cups on the trot, he got knocked out. I think it was in the first or the second time basket against CSKA. And I think Ajax finished third or fourth in the league. And somehow he got the Dutch manager's job. Crazy, but there you go. And he was very much what you would describe as a guy who was really great help to me when writing the Dutch book. And he described him as a small town manager. So he's very much from not from a big club. I can't remember where he'd come from before, but it wasn't a big club, and he got the job at Ajax for 1 year and failed. And he was very much in the sort of under the sort of thumb of Cruyff. And Cruyff and Neeskens, who were at Barcelona by this sort of time, were taking advantage of their ability to dodge training sometimes and arrive late and sometimes go missing. And they arrived, there was ahead of the game against Poland and then a training camp in Amsterdam, Rotterdam, I think. And the rest of the squad were all there, sort of, right? And Cruyff and Neeskens rolled up. And it's sort of debatable whether it was Van Coylen or it was Van Beveren who said, here come the kings of Spain. And after that, Cruyff was either heard or was told about the comment, went to Knobel and said, it's either them pair or me. And obviously he favoured Cruyff, and so Van Beveren missed out again. And the PSV players were going to be, there was 4 or 5 players, obviously the Van der Kerkhoff brothers, twins were there, are going to sort of walk out in solidarity, but Van Beveren persuaded them not to. And then in 78, when Zwartkruis was coaching the club with the team along with Happel, he tried to bring Van Beveren back into the team. And unfortunately, because of Cruyff's dominance, even though he didn't play in the finals, we're talking about the qualifying tournament now and the games ahead of that, Cruyff didn't want him playing. So he took a sort of middle ground by putting Van Beveren on the bench rather than letting him play. And Van Beveren then got brassed off with it and sort of said, oh, I'm retiring from international football. So Van Beveren missed 3 international tournaments that he was the best goalkeeper by a country mile for, because of the politics between PSV and Ajax. Just go back to Van der Coylen. He played 500 games for over 500 league games for PSV. He scored 308 goals, and yet only played 22 games for the Dutch national squad. This is the sort of hassle you have with politics in Dutch football and the international squad.
Somebody should write a book on it.
I know. They should.
Yes, good. obviously, I suppose last question on this thing before we sort of come to your article then. In terms of, you know, in this period that obviously Aidan's written about, you know, starting in the 70s, you've covered it with your Cup Winners' Cup, UEFA Cup book. Gary's covered it with his sort of book on Dutch football, the international scene. So in your perspective then, does domestic club football in Holland at this point, does it get a little bit lost? Now, I'd include PSV in this, behind the absolute success of Ajax domestically and European, and obviously the reputation and so very near success of the Dutch national team. Does that actually mask the quality that existed in Dutch football at that time?
Yes, it does. I mean, the quality in the Eredivisie at the time was massive. Yet this still wasn't diluted by the fact that players were, you know, being shipped abroad to different teams in different leagues, where you had a player like Rob Rensenbrink, who prospered more in Belgian club football than he did in the Netherlands. You know, they could lose these iconic players, or what would become iconic players, yet another one, you know, another star would step into the breach. So yes, Dutch domestic club football in the 1970s was you know, hugely, if a high quality, but yes, it is somewhat shielded behind the Netherlands national team and the exploits of not just Ajax and winning that hat-trick of European Cups, but Feyenoord's successes in 1774, because they won the UEFA Cup in 74, and then PSV as well. And as Aidan spoke before, you know, they'd had near misses. They only went out narrowly to Saint-Étienne in 76, went out to them again the following year in an earlier round. They'd had a good Cup Winners' Cup run at the beginning of the decade as well. So yes, and it wasn't just about them either. You know, you've got to look at the rise of AZ Alkmaar, who would be champions by, 1980, I think it was, reached the UEFA Cup final in 81, sorry, champions in 81. So yeah, the rise of AZ. You also had Twant, who were somewhat the hard done by. You know, they exited the decade with one, maybe two, KMVB Cups, lost a couple of finals that they shouldn't have done, put themselves in a good position in the first leg of the 1975 UEFA Cup final to blow it in the second leg. So yeah, the depth of quality is what's most telling here. You know, it's quite startling really, but yes, it is without doubt that quality of Dutch domestic football back then is very much, it plays third fiddle almost to the national team and the club exploits across Europe.
It seems like we've got a little bit, not a little bit, stuck in the 70s, but it's such an important part of Dutch football, and obviously it's an important part of PSV's early development, early progression, early sort of coming to the fore in regards to Dutch football. And obviously your article, Stephen, is on the Van der Kerkhoff twins, which again, sort of brothers, or, you know, twins who play football, and that, you know, they sort of one being better than the other, or, you know, how families could, you know, it's so difficult to become a professional footballer, but then to, you know, for families to be able to produce two within the same generation, again, is something that is sort of quite fascinating. I suppose if you're into genetics, it's probably even more fascinating, but it's just something that, you know, that really interests me. And obviously you've gone down that road with your article.
Yeah, and I think I enjoyed writing that article in way of it being a learning curve as well, because there's so much about them that is, again, hidden because of that concept that the twins. So, you know, people look, the football and twins, and then there's something else that catches the eye, be it Rensenbrink, be it Rett, be it Cruyff. You know, they had so many rivals. The fact that they were playing for PSV rather than Ajax, you know, I'd probably say if you just stopped any, you know, casual football fan in the street who probably knows the stuff, and you say, well, tell me something about the Van der Kerkhoffs, apart from the fact that the twins, apart from the fact that that cast before the 1978 World Cup final, they probably are pushed to come up with a lot of information about them because of this novelty aspect to them. But the thing about the Van der Kerkhoffs was that they're unlike any other sibling in a way. Football and siblings is that, yes, you can add the fact that the twins into this as well, but so many kind of legacies that are left by footballing siblings, there tends to be a yin and a yang to them. You know, you can look at Jack Charlton and Bobby Charlton. You know, one's hitting the ball in from 30 yards, he's the all-action hero, the other one's the stopper. You know, he self-confessed, you know, ruiner of football matches. Yeah, that was his game, that was his job. You know, you can probably point to the Nevilles being, you know, defensive brothers, but, you know, we're talking kind of like these two, the Van der Kerkhoffs. It was the amazing thing is that they were both epically talented footballers, both massively, massively skilled. They moved. The only other comparison I could probably come up with them is the Laudrups. That they were both offensive attacking players, skillful players. But the differences between the two was that René was more of a maverick and Willie kind of played the percentages a little bit. He played in a deeper role. He maybe had more strings to his bow. René was probably that little bit more naturally gifted, but not by much. Yet he was the typical maverick. You know, he suffered by the fact that he had so many rivals in the national team for a place in what was essentially a front three. You know, you can add Jan Kaiser to that as well, and so many others that came along. But Willie van der Kerkhoff, he prospered by the fact that he could push into that front three, but he could drop back into the middle. So the fact that he had more strings to his bow meant that he ended up prospering more than René did at international level. But the two of them were utterly fascinating to kind of map their careers. René was gone by 82, 83. He'd kind of burnt brightly. And then he kind of extinguished his career, exhausted it somewhat. Whereas Willie seemed to grow with age. He matured with age. I think he adapted his game to suit his age. Whereas René, not a one-trick pony as such, but he just played the way he knew. And as age caught up with him, he couldn't adapt. So Willie's career stretched that bit longer. His international career stretched for a further 3 years. You know, he was on the bench for the 1988 European Cup final. This was five or six years after René had gone. You know, for those last few years of Willie's career, where he's still being an influence on the national team and for PSV. You know, his brother René is playing second division football. So, you know, there's quite a stark difference between the two. Yet the talented one, the more talented one, marginally more talented, was the one that burnt brightly and then faded quicker. And it was just really fascinating to chart the progression of the careers. And the fact that, you know, going back to what we were saying about the PSV influence on like the 1974 World Cup, and how it was kind of shrouded somewhat by the dominance of Ajax and Feyenoord. And the fact that Jan van Beveren and Willy van der Kuylen missed out so much because they were the most dominant PSV figures. But the Van der Kerkhoffs were possibly seen as less threatening, as a less threatening aspect of the PSV team to invite into the national squad. René was again somewhat unlucky in that there was that switch of managers before the 1974 World Cup finals. The man prior to Meikles, the man who took them to the took them through the qualifiers, František Fadronk, he had brought René into the side on a more regular basis, played a lot of the qualifiers in the second half of the qualifiers there. And he'd kind of made himself a semi-regular, but then when Meikles took over, there was a change of personnel on the pitch as well. And René fell onto the periphery again. So while both of them went to the World Cup finals in 1974, between the two of them, they only played 45 minutes, and that was the second half of the final, and René played all 45 of those. replacing like the injured Rob Rensenbrink. So it was fascinating to see this kind of progression, not just at club level, but for the national side, because there was this brilliant kind of full circle to it as well, because they'd started out together at Twente, and Keith Reavers had been the coach at Twente. He'd left in 72 to take the PSV job, went back a year later to sign the Van der Kerkhof twins. And then later on, 81 to 84, Reavers was the Netherlands national coach. So it was that occasion where Spain needed to win by 11 goals against Malta to deny the Netherlands a place in the finals of the 1984 European Championships, and won 12-1. And within that, Willy van der Kerkhof was still a huge part of that side. So there was this, it was just an amazing kind of story to tell, but the fact that so much of it was, you know, it overlapped, interlinked. There was the rise and the fall of one, and then the consistent progression of the other, and then all of it interlinked and holding hands with this coach that had been such an omnipresent figure for them in three spheres at Twente, at PSV, and for the national side. It was it was a brilliant, illuminating article to write, and whether anyone reads it or not, I got a lot out of it.
I'm sure you will, having listened to all of that, you know, as part of a taste. And like I say, you know, twins, football and siblings, you know, is something that fascinates me. And I guess, I know we sort of keep coming back to sort of your book, Gary, but I guess
I'll just add to that, this is the YouTube klaxon as well. Look out, go for the 1978 UEFA Cup final and just put in Rennie van der Kerkhof 1978 UEFA Cup final. And there's the most beautiful piece of skill that he pulls off, where he lobs the ball over his brother's head at one point, and it all starts from dispossessing Johnny Rapp of the ball. And it is the most incredible. If you've ever seen Jerry Muren's control of the ball for Ajax against Real Madrid in the European Cup in the early 70s, this is as comparable. So that's your YouTube klaxon, and now carry on.
Brilliant. No, absolutely. Everyone will now just be pressing pause while they're listening to this to go watch it. So while they're pressing pause, Gary, obviously I'm guessing, you know, the brothers have again featured strongly around the narrative of your book.
Yeah, defo. And Steve's right, actually, you know, what he says about they were sort of seen as the non-threatening PSV contingent. Van Beveren and Van der Kerkhof, for fairly obvious reasons, were fairly strident figures. The other two would tend to be more in the background. And there's a couple of interesting things. Obviously, you know, Stevie mentioned that René came on as a sub in 74 final for Rensenbrink, but both twins started the 78 final, and there was a big kerfuffle before kickoff about the cast that Rennie had on his wrist. I think he'd hurt it in the game against Austria, I think. I can't remember now. But he wore the same cast all the way through, and the Argentines were mismaking something down about it just to create a bit of delay and hassle for the kickoff. But there's the YouTube klaxon in that same tournament, in the 2-2 draw with the Germans, Rennie van der Kerkhof scored the equalising goal. And if you want to see a composure and unflustered, when everybody else is losing their head and you stay calm, this guy had ice in his veins. Wonderful, wonderful calm goal. I was talking to a guy called Jan Helman de Bruyne, who's a journalist in Holland, who's helping me with the book, and he sort of pointed me at this, and you know, he said, you know, if you want to see a guy with ice in his veins, this is the guy. It's a wonderful goal. And the other thing is to mention about the Van der Kerkhof twins in 78 is that Cruyff is always sort of famous, stroke, infamous, the way you look at it, for sort of having the two stripes rather than three stripes on his shirt, because he was sponsored by Puma and the national team was sponsored by Adidas. In 78, there were three players who did the same thing. Dirk Nanninga, who scored the goal, the equaliser in the final, and the other two were the PSV players, the Van der Kerkhof twins, who strangely were still playing for PSV at the time, who were sponsored by Adidas, and PSV had three stripes on their sleeves, but that didn't seem to matter for some reason.
There you go. You see, that's why you're our Dutch football expert, Derek. All things Dutch. Aidan, I suppose a question for you. In terms of, you know, coming back to this, the sort of concept of brothers, do you, you know, you look at the Loudrups, you know, and Steve has mentioned, you know, the Nevilles, the Charltons, you know, and the game, there are, you know, there are sort of, you know, brothers and siblings throughout the history of the game. But do you think people get not so much slightly more hung up on the fact that they are a brother or that they are a twin, but do you think that almost the career is defined by the fact that they are a brother?
I think yes. And I think it takes away from some of what their individual achievements are, because it's always part of a pair, or even more so if at the same club, which Van der Kerkhove twins, and I guess the Nevilles will have had this throughout. One is always compared to the other. And I guess that's a natural reaction. I mean, that must be most prominent when they're at the same club, but still happens regardless, just because they're purely brothers who are playing in the same time. And that must be intensely infuriating to them, I would think. You can imagine the same things happening with any sibling partnership. Now, the Loudrups, the Koemans as well, keeping it with the Netherlands and PSV a little bit. I think it's a natural reaction, but it's not entirely fair, is it? It's not very kind to them to judge a career in that way. And I guess it must be hardest of all for the sibling who is judged by history to be the poorer of the two, because, you know, they're constantly referred to as being not as good as their brother and not the best in their family. And that must be really irritating, especially when both, as in this case, or in the cases of the Loudrups, the Koemans, the Charltons and so on, the Nevilles as well, have all reached international standard and have all gone to tournaments and so on, but one has done it in a possibly better way than the other, to a higher level or more iconic. And therefore, you know, to be constantly drummed home that you're not even the best in your own family, no matter the fact that you're world class, that's got to be annoying. Got to be annoying.
Yeah, if you're not even the best player sat at the dinner table, yeah. It's not going to make you feel good, is it? That's a great answer, because that's exactly how I think about it as well. So yeah, I'm happy with your answer there, Aidan. That was excellent.
Good stuff.
Garrett, obviously, you know, we need to sort of leave the 70s. We're nearly an hour in already, and we sort of need to leave the 70s. And we mentioned at the beginning, you know, sort of this litany of names of players and managers, that it's only upon sort of careful consideration that you realise who has gone through the ranks at PSV. You know, some for prolonged periods of the career, some sort of fleeting appearances. And I guess, Gary, your article, you know, like you mentioned at the beginning, you know, truly, truly world-class footballer. But it was sort of for the briefest of moments, but the impact, I suppose, not just on PSV or Dutch football, but it was, you know, it was the first glimpse. It was an, you know, that instant impact on the whole of European football, I guess.
Yeah. And obviously we're talking about El Famano Ronaldo. And it's interesting sort of lead into how he got to PSV. He was called up for the Brazilian squad for the World Cup USA 94. He didn't play, but he was called up there. And amongst the players there was Romario, who was just about to move from PSV to Barcelona. And there's been a lot of talk about Ronaldo being signed by some of the top European clubs. And Ronaldo himself, I've got to go see the article, said that it was Romario who convinced him to join PSV instead. That's almost like a stepping stone and easing into this sort of... rather than being dropped straight into the big deep pond, you sort of get it, step into the shallow end first and find your bearings and then move on from there. And Dayton, this guy was a 17-year-old kid, and he's another YouTube klaxon. Pick any game you'd like when he's playing in that first season at PSV. And you often see, you know, the good players, they look like a man. Looks like somebody's dad stepped into a kid's game and, you know, he sort of dominated the game. Well, this kid was 17. He was barely 17. And he looked like somebody's dad playing around somebody's kids, because he was just bullying everybody. He was quicker, he was stronger, he was better. He played 36 league games in that first season, scored 35 goals in his debut season in a foreign continent in a foreign country, not knowing the language, and scored almost a goal per game. The following season, the second season, he had the first of what would ruin his career was knee injury, and he missed a chunk of the season. And he played 21 games, 21 league games, but he still scored 19 goals. No, so I mean, this is crazy sort of goal scoring record for a guy who's, as I say, a young kid. If you signed a top striker in his prime, you know, 27, 28 year old, and he scored your 35 goals in 36 games in the first season, then 19, 21, you'd be ecstatic. But this guy was this was just a kid from South America, and then obviously he moved on to Barcelona. But you know, there's a great sort of comfort for PSV fans. I can't remember exactly the quote. I can't remember. It's in the article, though. It says, you know, if you can't have a great player for a great amount of time, have a great player for a great amount of goals, or something. I can't remember exactly, but it's something like that. But this guy was absolutely, you know, phenomenal. You know, this is not overstating this case. As I say, YouTube clacks and pick almost any game you want that season. And there's a compilation of Ronaldo's top 20 goals. Think about that. He ain't even half the goals he scored in a couple of seasons, but a season and a half, because he lost half a season through injury.
It's, I mean, you know, Stephen, you know, we've got, the, you know, there's, in fact, there's an article that Will Sharp's written for the magazine on Romario, and Gary's just mentioned him there, and obviously you have Ronaldo. And I guess, and you'll be able to answer this better than I can, I suppose, but in terms of players in that era, so we're sort of looking, you know, mid to late, sort of around the sort of 90s, that period of time, sort of mid to late 90s when they're starting to come across. Do you think that the Dutch league was perhaps, of all European leagues, was probably the most suitable and appropriate for young South American footballers to get their first taste of European football?
Probably yes. You know, the quality of the football was still quite high. It was still a competitive division. You got to bear in mind that up until the mid 1990s, there was a three foreigner rule in operation in all the major divisions, all the major leagues. So, you know, Serie A teams could only have so many non-Italian players. Same for the Spanish clubs. It was implemented in England for a bit, but it was less of an issue over here because our foreign players would tend to be predominantly Scandinavian. But yes, you know, the Eredivisie seemed to be a rich breeding ground for South American footballers to prosper in and to acclimatise to European football. And within that it was a bit of a, I don't know, a bit of a complex situation, really. I mean, people will stereotypically expect South American players to do better in Mediterranean countries. So Spain, Italy, Portugal, you know, working along that coastline, along that arc. But here we are with this league in Northern Europe, Northern mainland Europe, where South American players were blooming. And one of the biggest things for me, when it comes to the likes of Romario, Ronaldo, and many, many others, is that when they use PSV as a stepping stone, I'd argue that they went on to bigger and better things as such, but they maybe never quite enjoyed the football quite as much as they did than they did in a PSV Eindhoven shirt. You know, a sense of freedom and you know, to be able to express themselves without any kind of major terms and conditions to it. Once you leave that environment and go to a Barcelona or a Real Madrid or one of the giants of the Serie A, there is an expectation. There's certain levels of expectation and things that you've got to do. There's a huge amount of pressure on you, which is probably less so at a PSV or even an Ajax or a Feyenoord when you're playing for those in the early to mid 1990s, late 1980s onwards. So yes, I think it was. It was renowned for it as well. It was well known as being this stepping stone, this gateway into Europe for South American players. And within that, it kept Eredivisie football and Dutch domestic football as an attractive proposition. Certainly to watch games. We're talking about an era now where satellite television's kicked in. Eurosport, for instance, used to do the European roundup on a Monday tea time. It'd be about 6 o'clock on a Monday evening. They'd show the goals from the Eredivisie, La Liga, various other leagues that they could, were permitted to do so. So I can remember watching those and being transfixed by the goals of Romario. And again, that spike in interest of continental football came with Bobby Robson going and coaching over there between 90 and 92. This concept of the Eredivisie as a gateway into Europe was a very valid one.
Just coming to you as well, Aidan, because like I say, Steve has mentioned there, and Gary as well, the sort of not the flair players, but the goal scorers, the importance of goal scorers. And, again, another one that has gone through PSV is, Ruud van Nistelrooy. Ewan McTeer has written an article on McNillis, van Nistelrooy and Kesman, and that sort of world-class lineage of strikers. But I just want to sort of talk about van Nistelrooy in terms, Ronaldo and Romario that Stephen and Gary have just chatted about were a certain type of player, South American, that the flair and the extravagance that comes with that. But in terms of an out-and-out goal scorer, Ruud van Nistelrooy, for me, is, I would say, a little bit underrated in terms of how good he was as a natural goal scorer.
He was hugely prolific at that time, in the late 90s, obviously it was his era at PSV. The numbers he put up there alerted the bigger clubs. Manchester United came calling, and they had to wait a year because of a broken leg, and whether that diminished things slightly, it's hard to say. His style was, you talk there of the difference of flair from Romario and Ronaldo being the key strikers that PSV had earlier in the 90s through to Van Nistelrooy later on. Yes, he was utterly different as a striker. Didn't have the flair, didn't have quite the same skill set. But what he did have in common with them was hugely clinical finishing ability. The method of getting there would be different. He was much more physical, less extravagant and so on, but his ability to score goals was equally impressive. He went on to great prominence with Manchester United later on and with the Dutch national team too. I think time moved on from his style a little bit following there. So I guess the rise of the likes of Drogba and so on with a more all-round game as a striker took away from the pure striking talent that somebody like Van Nistelrooy had. But the era he came through at, he was supreme in his finishing ability. He could just... he's one of those with the canny knack of getting in the right place at the right time so often. But he could also force his way to be in the right place at the right time. He wasn't just sort of ghosting into position like some strikers do. He was a physically dominant player, hugely strong, but his clinical nature in front of goal just took him up a notch or two above many others. And he followed a similar path, I guess, in terms of PSV and then on to the bigger clubs of Europe, but without quite the same level of worldwide stature that Romario and Ronaldo achieved. But for a time, his goal-scoring prowess was astonishingly good.
Obviously, like I say, we could chat about players and sort of eras and dynasties, and the action that's actually on the pitch. But obviously, as part of the magazine, as we like to do, we like to look at the club as a whole. We like to look at the development of players at the club. We like to look at the stadium, but obviously just as important are the managers that have also sort of gone through the club as well at various stages within their careers, some at the beginning, some at the end, some in their prime. And obviously, Gary, I'm going to start with you because I know he's one of your all-time favourites. But obviously Bobby Robson's time, and it was mentioned at the beginning, there was the scenario with him sort of losing his job with England just before the 1990 World Cup, and how it was almost traitorous that he was going to leave and work in Holland following that World Cup. But a little bit about Bobby Robson and his time at PSV.
Yeah, and interesting you say about the treacherous thing. I think it was a Today newspaper who sort of called him a traitor, and Bobby Robson, an extremely proud Englishman, sued and got damages from the newspaper because of it, because his reason that he left England, it wasn't his choice. It was Bert Milicic basically saying, if you don't win the World Cup, your contract's not going to get renewed, which is, kind of stupid thing the FA put into. But anyway, so, Bobby Robson left England and he succeeded Gus Hiddink. Now, Gus Hiddink had took the European Cup to PSV. He'd won the league in 87, 88, 89. He'd won the KMV Cup in 88, 89, 90. I mean, it's the kind of guy, it's like taking over from Alex Ferguson, and you know how that works. But so Bobby Robson, there again, we've all got sort of different opinions about different managers. But he was there for 2 years. He won the league title in both of those years before moving on. And, he kept the ship steady. It was a typical Dutch club with lots of sort of, strong personalities, including Romario at the time. But Sir Bob did the sort of thing that Sir Bob does. He sort of brought success to the club, took over a difficult situation, very much like afterwards he took over Barcelona, taking over from Cruyff. Talk about taking over from Ferguson again. And he delivered success to PSV. So by almost anybody's measure, he did really well there. It's such a difficult situation to take over from a guy who's delivered the European Cup and, three or four Eredivisie titles and the same number of KMV Cups as well.
Like I say, there's again we can go through and there's some other managers that I want to sort of touch on with regards to their time at PSV and for you, Stephen, one that's I suppose quite interesting. Paul McPartland's written an article about him, and that's Philip Cocu, and that's we've mentioned in the Mount Rushmore series that we do, and we've mentioned it a couple of times at the end of an era podcast series that we're doing as well, is that sometimes some players, sort of then move on to the back room with regards to the club that they've made their name at and almost sort of cements their legacy with the club, no matter where else they go, where else they've played, what else they go on to do post-playing career. And Philip Cocu is, again, I suppose, is PSV's version of that, if you like.
Oh, yeah, definitely. I mean, he's so entwined with PSV as a club, to star for them as a player of purpose in two separate spells to depart for Barcelona, but then to go back again. And I think the fact that, when he went back, he'd have had other options on the table. He'd have had other offers, but then he's grasped the chance to go back to PSV and to work under Hiddink. Part of a PSV side that came to within minutes of reaching the 2005 Champions League final. You can't underestimate or downplay his influence on PSV, and it's the learning that he did as a player as well, and the coaches that he served under that he's taken into his managerial career as well. So to go back a third time as coach and to be a player of substance and then to follow that up with a successful coaching career is still quite a rare thing. It's still a very rare thing. So to go back and win what must be three Eredivisies, I think he's won as a coach. And then obviously he's branching out again to go elsewhere, but you wouldn't back against him tipping up at PSV again. But I think it's one of those. It's those great senses of it being like a family tree, whereas it's passed from generation to generation. So he learns from Hiddink. He will pass it on to somebody else. From the players to have served under Cocu, the teammates that he's had. Someone will spring forth and be a coach of substance themselves a generation further on, and Cocu, he he ticks all of these boxes. You know, massively, massively important to PSV, and I'm sure he will be again.
It's just coming to you, Aidan, and obviously, you know, we've looked at you know, Bobby Robson there and Philip Cocker as well, and two obviously almost opposite ends of the spectrum in terms of management experience, what, you know, what they've gone on and done. But, and sort of, you know, Gary mentioned, and Gus Hiddink, and there, you know, Gary sort of briefly started to mention the success that he had, and, you know, how do you follow that legacy? And I guess, you know, in terms of managers, does Gus Hiddink's sort of legacy or shadow still loom large over PSV and managers that are still to come?
It has to, really, doesn't it? Because he's the one who achieved the Holy Grail. No one else has achieved what he did in terms of European glory. And I guess Keith Rivers, who we talked about earlier, is the only one who has come remotely close to achieving that level. Talk about some of the great players who've been there since, but for all the scoring feats and Eredivisie titles, none of them have come remotely as close to the Hiddink side of reaching European glory. I mean, it was his first management job as well, so this is quite a success for somebody starting out in the game. And obviously, we all know what he's gone on to achieve since then in a whole host of countries around the world, in terms of international success and club success. But it all began in PSV. He'd been an assistant there for a little bit, I think, prior to taking over. But I think what he created there, and I think this is something that you can see in particularly some of the national teams he's coached since, is he created a real sense of unity within the group. So in this case, within the club environment at PSV. And I think that's what helped push them onto a higher level than possibly they'd been able to achieve or might have been able to achieve without it. So I think that was one of his great, great skills. But yeah, coming back to your question, I think the shadow is always going to loom over PSV. I think any club that's had minimal great achievement, if you want to view it that way, in terms of the biggest trophy of all that they could possibly get, to have only done it once, I think it's clear that shadow will linger for anyone, because it's an impossible thing for anyone to live up to in some ways, given the way the game has changed. PSV Eindhoven achieving those heights again seems less likely than it would have done back in the early 90s, I guess. And so it is something that's going to be a struggle for anyone else to match up to. But I guess that just enhances his legacy further.
I suppose it's a double-edged sword, isn't it?
Yeah.
You know, Hiddink becomes more and more revered as time goes on, but unfortunately it becomes more and more difficult for sort of future incumbents of the managerial seat.
Quite, I know. It's a bit unfortunate, isn't it? But that's just the way it goes with the game currently, of how things have changed. But I mean, he was, of course, an excellent manager in his own right, regardless of what the era was. He pushed PSV to great heights, and he's done it with a whole host of teams since then too. So, you know, he truly is a managerial legend, certainly.
Absolutely. So we've been chatting as always. We know we're well past the hour already. And obviously, you know, start to draw it to a close. Before the sort of final question, you know, just wanted to remind people that are listening, you know, this magazine's going to be out the 9th of November to pre-order. And like I say, once they're gone, but that is exactly how it is. And it's not so much a YouTube klaxon, but more a credit or debit card klaxon, maybe, just to remind people while they're listening to actually remember to order it once they finish listening. And we've only touched on sort of five or six of the articles that are in there. There's still, you know, plenty to read about with regards to PSV and their position within Dutch football, European football, and even world football. But before we go, a slightly different question this time, rather than favourite player or favourite moment. I'm going to ask you all for something, it can be anything you want, for something in your opinion that is unique to PSV. We've talked a lot about Ajax, we've talked a bit about the Dutch way, the Dutch national side, and how a lot of Dutch football all seems to link together. But, you know, we've put together a magazine about this club, so there has to be I'm saying there has to be, because I don't even have to answer it. I am really sorry. But so there has to be a unique element to this club. So, you know, if I was to ask each of you to sort of come up with something that is unique to PSV, to PSV Eindhoven. Are you all ready?
Oh my word.
I did try to ask the question a little bit earlier, but nobody replied to me, so I've just gone with it anyway. I'll start with you, Stephen, because Aidan was talking, so we won't have had time to read what I wrote. So I'm going to start with you, Stephen, I'm afraid.
No, that's all right. I would say something that is unique to PSV is I think their sense of education, you know, but being able to marry that within remaining successful and, you know, being a club that still wins things, because they are often used as a stepping stone, as we've mentioned, but they're a club where, you know, Romario's gone there and learned how to play European football and then got onto great things. You know, Ronaldo has gone there, learned how to play European football and got on to great things. You know, the rise of Hiddink, you know, the Koku as player and coach, you know, the goals of Van Nistelrooy and that sense of, you know, a dead-eye shot for goal and being so ruthless in the 18-yard box. And I just think there's this way with PSV is that these players, no matter, and coaches, no matter what style they purvey, what position they play, you know, whether that's, you know, the man on the touchline or the goalkeeper or the goal scorer or the player who creates, there seems to be this, I don't know, it's almost like a club where a genesis will happen. You know, there's a sense of football alchemy that goes on at PSV, and then it's allowed to just stretch out to other clubs then. You know, there's a sense of how the lessons and the learning that they take on at PSV is, you know, they then take on to another club. But then it's never kind of lost. It still feels very PSV. You know, all those goals that Van Nistelrooy scored for Manchester United and later on Real Madrid, he still felt very PSV, you know, in some manner. Hiddink, no matter where he goes, still feels very PSV. What he, you know, delivers, what he produces, just feels inherently PSV. And I can't really suggest another club that engenders that kind of feeling about their players, both past and present, you know, their coaches. You know, they go elsewhere, yet they still remain PSV.
I've got to say, that's probably one of the best answers you've ever given. What a great answer to that question.
Thanks, Stu.
I don't know how Gary and Aidan are feeling, but
he's not left us anything to say.
I don't know. No pressure, lads.
That was such a good answer. That was such a good answer. Gary.
Okay. Well, PSV were formed in 1913 by the Philips company, which is a fairly sort of unusual way for a football club to come about. And for the first few decades, only employees of Philips could play for the club. Obviously, that sort of changed over time. And but up until the turn of the centuries, and then the year 2000, they remained an association rather than a limited company. It was only in I think it was actually in late 1999 that they became a limited company and were compelled to have a board of directors. But even then, the board of directors had no decision-making process at all. They were just advisory. And the club was still run basically as an association. And all the shares, but one, of the club are owned by the foundation, PSV Football, which is a charitable organisation. And one other thing, in 1950, the first televised match in the Netherlands was a game between PSV and EC Eindhoven, a derby game. And it was the first ever match in the Netherlands. And of course, the technology was supplied by Philips.
Brilliant, Gary. Aidan, oh dear. Brilliant answer, Gary. I knew you wouldn't let me down. I knew you wouldn't let me down. Well done, guys. That's two for two. And this is obviously why one of the reasons why we've decided on PSV as a magazine, because there is so many stories within the club and so much uniqueness. And Aidan's about to give us one more piece of uniqueness if he's still on the line.
Oh, yeah. Oh, my God. Sometimes going last isn't the best. I don't know. I think what I'm going to have to go with is it's a slight variation of what Stephen said, because his answer covered almost everything. So, you know, I have to adapt a little bit of it. In that I think some of the hugely impressive players that they've had over the time. So if you think of Romario and Ronaldo in particular, and I guess... No, let's keep it with those two, because otherwise it spoils my point. If we keep it to them, I think PSV have, for Dutch football, had imports of a calibre that seems to be a bit beyond the club's stature, and yet it seemed quite right because it was the stepping stone and the education, as Stephen mentioned. It was their first port of call from Brazil into European football, and it pushed them through. But it feels slightly out of whack with the stature of Dutch football and the club to have had players of that great renown. And yet, also, it was the perfect place for them. So I don't mean to sort of denigrate PSV by saying that, because I think it was the perfect place for them to develop into the players they became. But I think it's different to how Ajax and Feyenoord would have been. They didn't have anyone of this stature at all, not of that hugely successful world caliber in those eras, imported. And so I think that's what makes them unique. And possibly it's just unique in Dutch football rather than beyond. But it's players of truly world-class caliber coming through there that feels slightly out of context with the club's stature and yet also feels right.
Hey, guys, you never fail to amaze me. All three of you. This is why you are my most favourite people to talk to in the world. Aidan, brilliant. It's again another great answer, and it was different. You know, it was separate to what Steve said, and I absolutely got the concept that you were talking about, guys. Like I say, it's been another hour and a half of wonderment on my part. Hopefully, well, I'm sure you'll have done enough to convince people, certainly who are new to these football times or maybe new to the podcast, maybe aren't quite aware of the magazine and the sort of cult following that it has, or, you know, that we're quite a way down the line now with club editions, and this is just the next one sort of on the conveyor belt of brilliance. And I don't mean to sort of, you know, be quite arrogant and big-headed about it. That's not where we're coming from. But, you know, the feedback that we get from these magazines is how good they are and, you know, which club are we doing next and which club's getting the treatment. And I think, you know, certainly everybody who's contributed to it in terms of written articles, the artists that have contributed to it, the photographs that are in there, and obviously you three guys as well that have been so informative and, you know, and so educational on the podcast in this episode, will convince people, those new people, to go out and pre-order and make the purchase. Guys, it's time to say goodbye for now. Stephen, thank you very much.
Oh, joy as always, Stip.
Gary, obviously, like we said about an hour and a half ago, this was always going to be one of your favourite subjects.
Yeah, definitely. I can't wait to read the magazine as well, matey. It's going to be a barn burner.
And Aidan... Brilliant, brilliant answering under pressure right at the end. It was world-class calmness personified is what it was.
I was panicking, you know. You didn't get to hear the full-on panic when everyone else gave their answers, when I was on mute going, oh, my God. But, you know, we got there in the end. But this is going to be another excellent magazine. And as we said at the start, it's a club that nobody's going to dislike. Everyone's going to have a fondness for. And I think that will show through in all of the articles in the magazine.
Absolutely. All that's left for me to say is once more, please don't delay with the pre-order, because like we say, once they're gone, and they cost a fortune on eBay now, some of the more difficult ones to get to. So thank you for listening. Don't forget to pre-order. Don't forget to watch the YouTube clips that have been suggested. And please join us again next time on the Lob Podcast with These Football Times. Thank you and goodbye.
Many thanks for joining us today on The Lob, a These Football Times production. For more of our content, check out our award-winning print magazine featuring some of the game's foremost writers, artists and photographers, exploring areas of the game rarely covered in high-end print. For now, we look forward to you joining us again soon.